Welcome to Primetime Sports for Monday, July 11th. The network now joins us. I am Jeff Blair, sitting in for Bob McCowan, Michael Grange to my right, in the co-pilot seat, or whatever the hell they call it in the studio.
Co-host
seat. Okay. Grange in the co-host seat. He'll be here all week except for Friday, and I won't be here Thursday. We don't need to get into the whole scheduling thing anyhow. It's Blair and Grange for the next hour. That's all you need to know. And right off the bat, you like that, eh? Right off the bat, we go to one of our favorites. Keith Law of ESPN joins us to talk about Major League Baseball's first half. Mr. Law, thank you for joining us today, sir.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
I'm looking at the first half of Major League Baseball, and again, it's we'll say the pre-All-Star portion of Major League Baseball. The half actually arrived a couple of weeks ago, but when you look around baseball right now, and I'm reading your piece, there are three teams I think we agree that are surprises: Pittsburgh Pirates, the Diamondbacks, and the Indians. What I want to know from you, Keith, is which of these three teams, let's assume at the trade deadline that they're all still in the fringes of contending or they're in the picture, which of these three teams do you think makes the wow move at the trade deadline?
I think Arizona. I think that, one, we know Kevin Towers kind of has the gunslinger reputation and is certainly willing to be active. And I know, it's partially because I live out here, but I know ownership has said, yeah, we'll make money available to go get a player. Yeah, we're in this for the long haul. They hired Kevin Towers because they wanted a quick fix to try to turn the club around and potentially create a winner here after the club had really cratered the last couple of years with Josh Burns as the GM, and they had a lot of organizational problems as well, which also led them to make the change. So I see top to bottom there the commitment to going out and doing something. Whereas with Cleveland and Pittsburgh, I don't think either club has a ton of money to work with. And those are two pretty sharp front offices that have to look at the underlying talent and figure, yeah, we're close to first place right now, but we're not as good as the teams that we're competing with.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have to make a major move just to hang with the clubs they're fighting against, particularly Pittsburgh. They're kind of playing over their heads right now. They're not as good as Milwaukee, not as good as St. Louis. You're really going to go out and torch your rebuilding plan just to make one run at contention when the club you have isn't that good? I just don't see them doing that.
And of course, I would argue, Keith, that the Arizona Diamondbacks, the Diamondbacks are the Giants are the team they have to beat, and I think the Pirates are in a four team race. And as you well know, it's a lot harder to beat three other teams than it is to kind of zero in on one.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the other thing for Arizona too is you got to look at the Giants club and figure they're flawed. It's a great team in terms of, well, it's really great rotation. It's a great pitching staff, 1-12. They don't have a good manager. They don't have a good offense. It's not a great defensive club. You know, Giants probably need to go out and make a move. I've been saying for a while, if there's any team that should go get Jose Reyes, that's who it is, because they're running a pointed stick out there at shortstop most days. It's not hard to upgrade over that. You go from basically getting zero out of your shortstop to maybe the best player in the National League. Assuming the Mets would move him and they're kind of acting like they won't, I still think they will. Yeah, if you can do that, that might be worth two or three extra wins just over the rest of the season. And the Giants, you won last year. You know you're not far away. They go get Jose Reyes, they got a great chance to get back to the World Series. That's the club where I think it makes sense to go out and gut the farm system a little bit when you know you're maybe one piece away from not just a playoff berth, but a slightly better chance to advance once you get into the playoffs.
Keith, you have your story here, nine positives for the first half, and one of them you included was Jose Bautista. Is that because you were expecting some kind of regression based on last year's out of nowhere, so to speak, season? Or
I don't know what piece you're... It's not my piece.
Oh, sorry, I apologize.
But I will say I was expecting a regression from Jose Bautista, and you're not seeing it at all. And I argued, it actually sort of popped up on Twitter the other day, where a couple of national writers down here have said Adrian Gonzalez is the AL MVP. If the season ended right now, they say, the MVP of the first half, which is essentially saying if the season ended today, the MVP is Adrian Gonzalez. And I said, I don't understand that at all. There is no question here who the most valuable player in the American League has been. This is not like, well, we've got two players who are kind of close and we'll give the nod to the guy in contention. Bautista has, I think it's like 60 points of on-base percentage and 80 or more points of slugging percentage. on Gonzalez and more on just about any other player you could mention. And Bautista plays a more difficult position. Gonzalez is a very good defensive first baseman, so I'll give him credit for that. These guys are not close. This is not a debate. Could Gonzalez close the gap? Bautista has a disappointing second half? Yeah, stuff like that happens all the time. But that's not the question. The question, I mean, these are well-known national writers down here who are arguing with a straight face that Gonzalez is the most valuable player in the American League so far. And I just thought that was complete craziness.
Keith Law joins us on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590. Keith, I did want to ask you about one team that has kind of interested me in the past week, and I started thinking about them a little bit when I took a look at the standings. Now, the Tampa Bay Rays are what, nine games over 500, eight games over 500, whatever it is. Pretty, you know, considering what they lost in the offseason, it's a pretty good place to be. But I don't, do you think that they're about 2 weeks away from deciding whether or not they really have the horses to run at the Red Sox and Yankees? And
maybe, I think they'll be opportunistic. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, go ahead. No, not at all.
Knowing that front office and how they're sort of in a constant buy and sell mode.
Right.
That if they can move pieces around, they might sell one day and then go out and buy the next just because they see some value. The one thing I don't expect them to do is buy a rental player. Mm-hmm. Go out and get a significant piece who's a free agent after the season. As much as they love having the draft picks, you know, they did just do that, right? They had 12 picks in the draft a couple of weeks ago. So I don't think they're going to be quite as keen to just get draft picks in return. But if they could get a player who helps them the rest of this year and 2012, or maybe end 2012 and 2013, I think that's much more likely. And at the same time, any pieces they have, even minor pieces, that they feel like they can just get good value for, whether or not these guys are headed for free agency, I think they're more likely to explore that. And it may be that they have to do both, clear a little money in one place so that they can go out and acquire that value piece who will help them next year in a second deal.
Keith, it seems kind of crazy to suggest a team playing 626 is maybe underachieving, but the Phillies, how do you evaluate them? So much hype with their pitching staff. They've had a couple of injuries, but I keep looking at them and they're just winning 6 out of 4, 7 out of 10. Sorry, 6. You know, they're going 6-4, 7-3. I'm waiting for them to really get on a roll.
You know, the injuries are really significant. Not having Utley in the first half, I think, made that lineup look substantially worse than it should be. Over the long haul, and I believe Victorino is hurt now, so they just can't catch a break in terms of getting everyone healthy. But the front three in that rotation have been so good. Halladay is starting the All-Star game for the NL, and deservedly so, and he'd probably be the Cy Young winner if the season ended today. Hamels has been right there with them. And I think that rotation has really kind of gotten them through and sets them up very well. Again, they get to the playoffs, they're going to be very tough to beat just with that front three. They do need to get everybody healthy by October. And I think if you're sitting in the Phillies front office, the one thing you've got to hope for is you build up enough of a lead that you can go into September and just try to rest a few of these guys, because it's an older lineup. I mean, that ultimately is what this comes down to. Is guys in their 30s just get hurt more often. And Chase Utley, as good as he is, he gets hurt a lot at this point. So any way you can get to September where you don't have to clinch on Labor Day, but you know you're comfortable enough that every day you can give a guy a day off just to try to make sure that when you get to October 1st, all of those key players are healthy, because they just haven't had their whole lineup together very much this year.
Keith Law joins us in Primetime Sports. Now, if you look at the Red Sox and the Yankees, both of them have, I would argue, they still have significant issues with starting pitching as good as they've been. And I mean, maybe the Yankees can keep it up. I remain skeptical about their starting pitching.
I do too.
I mean, there's a guy who may or may not be on the market in Matt Garza. Do you see these two teams getting into a bidding war for whatever pitcher is available out there? Because I've got to think the Red Sox, you know, at this point, why not add another starting pitcher?
I think anybody the Yankees are interested in, you know, the Yankees are going to go look for a starter, especially because all three of their top starting pitching prospects in the high minors have two of them have really struggled. Betances has pitched reasonably well, but the word I'm getting from a lot of scouts is not ready. He's not very athletic. He doesn't command the fastball enough. I saw him last year, too. This all syncs up. I mean, you couldn't call him up now. May still be a starter long term. None of these guys is going to help them right now. And so as a result, I think they're going to have to look out to the market and maybe even trade one of those guys to go out and get a starter to help them for the rest of this year. And once the Red Sox know that the Yankees are interested, the Red Sox will jump in, if only to drive up the price that the Yankees pay. And then maybe the Red Sox are just involved in all these talks. So if the Yankees overpay for someone, the Red Sox can swoop in, get the second best guy at maybe a relative discount. The problem for the Red Sox is that their upper minors is uncharacteristically thin. They've had a really strong farm system for several years now. But I actually just said, we did the Futures game broadcast yesterday, and they asked me for the top five farm systems. I had the Rays first and the Jays second. Hmm. For the first time in a long time, the Red Sox don't even have one of the two best farm systems in the division, and they might not even have a top half system in the game because of what's happened at the upper levels, promotions, trades, and disappointments. There's not a lot they can put together to go out and get an elite starter. Neither of those clubs is well-situated. I think if they go get a big piece, they might do it with money rather than with prospects.
Keith, regarding the Jays, you mentioned, is there anything outside their core of core players that would generate any interest in the trade market that, that in turn would advance the program here?
The problem for them, do I expect them to be active? Yes, because I think Alex Anthopoulos is somewhat addicted to the trade market, which is a very good trait in a GM. I mean, he's involved in everything, and if they can flip a piece just for something they think is more valuable, then I think they've made it pretty clear that they would do that. But the problem for them in terms of the ability to swing a major deal is that most of those parts, you're not going to trade Adam Lind. I don't think you could get proper value for Bautista at this point, mm-hmm. nor would you trade a guy you just signed to a long-term contract like that. Most of those critical guys, Romero, even Cecil, you're not going to trade any of those. You don't want to trade any of those pieces. What would have helped them, and I just don't know that this is going to happen over the next couple of weeks, Frank Francisco would actually pitch like a major league reliever at some point. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of guy who typically gets flipped at the deadline. But he's been such a disaster for them that I don't know that they could flip him for much of anything. Flipping him to a club that's looking for a closer, just a club that's looking for a right-hander in seventh inning. But he's been so bad lately, I don't know that they could get much value for him at all. He may be an August waiver claim type of trade. You put him out there, he gets claimed, you get a small piece in return.
Yeah, and I think, Keith, as well as anybody, that one thing teams generally will not do at the deadline. Everybody thinks they can reinvent the wheel in baseball, but boy, they really don't need, you don't need a project in August,
right.
Do you? You don't need a guy you're trying to, August 5th, you're hoping he can find the strike zone. You don't need that.
The history of these trade deals is that the guys who are the worst trade deals of all are the overperforming, especially right-handed, but just any kind of relief pitchers. Teams overpay for relievers who appear to be having good seasons, even if it's just kind of four fluky months. But the flip side of that is they almost never go out and acquire a reliever who's had a lousy 4 months, or a reliever who even the last couple of weeks, the other clubs have sent their pro scouts in there, I'm sure, to see the Blue Jays as part of routine coverage. What do you think those reports on Francisco look like right now?
Ooh.
Yeah. Those guys just don't get traded for anything of value.
Something was reported in the last week that kind of got under the radar here, went under the radar here, but I found interesting. It was just in a story on Aaron Hill. Aaron saying that he was under the impression that the Jays were going to talk to his agent in the second half. The Jays obviously have a couple of options on Aaron Hill. What would you do with him if you were the Jays? And just expand on that a bit. Is there any chance that he would have any trade value?
I think he would have trade value. As a former first rounder who's had a couple of really good seasons and is, as far as I can tell, physically fine. It's not a physical issue with him. And I've talked to a number of scouts, other clubs, execs that have played the Jays. Hey, what'd you think? Especially with the NL clubs. Hey, you haven't seen Aaron Hill before. You haven't seen him in years.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of this guy? And the one thing they all keep coming back to is, why is this guy trying to hit everything out of the park? When he was coming out of LSU, when he first got to the big leagues, short to the ball, tons of line drive contact, had a very good eye at the plate, just figured he'd be a high on base, doubles power kind of guy, maybe hit 10 to 15 home runs. And there's a feeling in baseball that one season where he hit 35.
Yep.
Was kind of the worst thing that ever happened to him because it changed his own perception of himself as a player. And I've seen this happen at all levels. I've seen it happen to college guys, and I've seen it happen to big leagues, where they try to be something that they're not. Aaron Hill is not a 30 home run a year guy. And I think we knew that, but it's still in his mind. I can drive the ball out. I can hit 25 to 30 bombs. and it's kind of ruined his approach.
Yeah, and
I don't
think,
see any physical reason why he couldn't go back and be the guy he was.
No, and I think, Keith, just further to that point, too, you know, I mean, he's not with the type of hitting coach who's going to tell him, kid, don't hit home runs.
Right.
I mean, he's not. You know as well as I do. I mean, Dwayne Murphy will take that.
Right.
He'll take that any day. And, I mean, I think a lot of us who kind of followed Aaron's career. Look, I've always thought he would have been, I would have put him in the number two hole. And I know the numbers aren't necessarily there, but to me, he's the type of guy, if you put in the number two hole, he can become an extension of the manager in the field. He's a smart enough guy. He does handle the bat well when he's forced to handle the bat well. I've just thought he would be a perfect number two hitter in this team.
Well, and especially the sort of the modern thinking on the number two hitter is not the guy who can bunt and maybe just hit the ball to the right side, but a guy who makes hard contact, who will work the count, who'll see a lot of pitches, who's got good recognition of off-speed, maybe just have the long at-bats of the 3-4-5 hitters early in the game, can get a look at the pitcher's repertoire, but also do something offensively. Get on base so that when, you know, the last thing you want is Bautista to keep coming up and hitting solo home runs.
Mm-hmm.
You want guys in front of him who are going to get on base, not just move a runner along. There's no point moving the guy from second to third when Bautista's coming up and he might hit the pitch into the third deck. So what Hill should be, the hitter that he was before the 35 home run season, the hitter I still think there's still a chance he could go back and be that guy again, that high on base, doubles, long at bats, hard contact. That's an ideal number two hitter. Maybe they put him in the two hole and that helps him change his mental approach. But I think there will be other clubs out there that at least ask the Blue Jays, can we get this guy at 50 cents on the dollar, knowing that his value is down, but we're willing to take the chance that maybe in a new environment with a different coach, we can coax that value back out of him.
Do you have any feel for Eric Thames? Eric Thames, he's been, he's kind of the flavor of the month here.
Yeah.
Do Jays fans need a bit of a reality check, or is this a guy who's getting a little buzz across baseball as a real prospect?
Yeah, I mean, I still think he's an extra guy, extra outfielder. He's got some power. That's the one real tool that you're banking on. He's not a good defensive outfielder. I think you've probably seen a little bit of that so far. I don't think he's going to get on base particularly high clip or even hit for a high average, given enough at-bats. You know, could he help them out in the short term? Hitting ahead of Bautista probably doesn't hurt him. I don't know if it helps him, but I doubt it's doing him any harm. Might see a few more fastballs in that situation. But long term, there's such an increased emphasis on defense, even in traditionally non-defensive positions like outfield corners, that for him, it's going to be hard to profile as an everyday player. He's going to have to turn into a 30 home run a year guy to profile despite below average defense in an outfield corner. So, I mean, I love the Jays farm system, but he was not a guy coming into the year that I would have said was among their top 10 or 15 prospects.
Keith, who is the next guy in the farm system?
I think it's Darnell. I mean, I'll give you two. I think Travis Darnell, the catcher, who has really had a breakout season. Everybody who runs in and sees him is just raving about him. I've loved him since high school, and I've probably told the story before. The Blue Jays were about to take him. The Phillies popped him one pick ahead, and the Blue Jays basically never gave up on it. When they finally had a chance to make a trade with the Phillies, they insisted that Darnell be in the deal. And I just saw Henderson Alvarez again in the Futures game out here yesterday. He was 93-97. The breaking ball is coming. It's a fringy pitch right now, but it's in there. I think he's just got to keep working with it. We know he's got a good changeup. He keeps the ball down. He gets a lot of ground balls. I'm just not sure what he is. I know he's a starter. I know he's a good starter. I don't know if he's a one, a two, or a three, but he's something. And he's not that far off. It's really about the development of the breaking ball. The breaking ball comes on to the point where it's just a usable pitch. You need just an average major league curveball with plus changeup, good velocity, pitch down in the zone, get ground balls. That's a big league starter, and it's almost there. It's just so close. I'm sure it's a little frustrating for the Jays to see him. It's like, man, that one night that curveball is there, we can probably run this guy right up to the big leagues because he's everything else is where you want it to be.
Keith, what do they do with Darno and Aaron Sebia?
It's a great question. I mean, it's a great problem to have.
It's a terrific problem, yeah.
I think, and you know, I'm extrapolating a little bit from the, you know, the regular conversations. I think they think Darno's the better long-term prospect. I know I do. I think that's an industry consensus. And at the same time, Aaron Sebia could start for 12 to 15 clubs around baseball for the next 4 or 5 years and do it for virtually no money.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is, if I'm right about what they think about Darno, my guess is they hang on to Aaron Sebia basically until the last possible second and then put him out on the trade market, maybe even put him out on the trade market ahead of time, recognizing you can go get something really valuable for an everyday catcher who makes $400,000. You don't keep both guys. Aaron Sebia is wasted as a backup, especially behind Darno, who who I think is going to be a 140-game-a-year catcher. You don't want Aaron Cebia catching 20, 30 games a year. Go out and get the missing piece. Aaron Cebia might turn out to be the valuable trade piece that helps make them a contender in 2012 or 2013.
Keith, before we let you go, just very quickly, is there anybody in that organization, in the Jays organization, that you look as a potential closer? Because that's a huge issue here, obviously, with Frank Francisco and John Roush. And Alex has said he's not a fan of taking a guy and saying, this guy's going to close. But is there a guy you see who could do that?
I mean, I see a lot of starters in that system who have this stuff. I mean, that's going from Alvarez to Hutchinson, I think Hutchinson's definitely a starter, or Aaron Sanchez, who mm-hmm. I love the arm, but very early. You know, he's kind of struggled at the start of his pro career. It's going to be one of these guys who we sit here today and we think, yeah, they're starters because they can hold the velocity, they got the big fastball, they got the good body, and just don't work out, don't miss enough bats as a starter. Historically, those guys tend to be the best closers. It's the failed starters, not the guy you specifically groomed for the ninth inning.
Keith, I really appreciate this today. Thanks so much for joining us. It's enlightening as always, my friend. Take care.
My pleasure, guys.
That is Keith Law of ESPN. Like having Keith Law on because, he knows a lot about the Jays farm system as well as what's going on in the major leagues. And you can also get from Keith a pretty undistilled report in the Jays farm system. And I've got to think for Jays fans, the fact that he has the organization ranked second, says a lot of positive things. And, let's just put it this way. It's going to be an interesting next couple of years. The Jays are going to have a couple of decisions to make with some fairly young players. And there certainly are some pieces if Alex Anthopoulos wants to pull off a major trade. There is a lot of talk that the National Football League labor stoppage is coming to a close. July 21st has been a date that has been mentioned. Clearly, there's positive momentum. And based on the number of NFL players that keep getting arrested, God can only hope that we get this thing done sooner. They may end up with half the league in prison. Nonetheless, Don Banks of SI will join us. We will talk about the NFL and, whether or not we're at the end of this labor stoppage. Don Banks next on Primetime Sports. We are back with Primetime Sports and the Fan Radio Network and Rogers Sportsnet. It's Blair. It's Grange. You believe it? The NFL, we may be at the end of our long NFL nightmare.
the lockout that wasn't?
Yeah. The one that everybody said was going to go thermonuclear. It appears as if there is positive momentum, at least. There have been some reports about a July 21st, a date for a possible agreement. I'm always skeptical when people put dates down for potential agreements because I've seen things happen at the last minute. But it does appear, at least, as I said, as if there's positive momentum. Don Banks joins us, our NFL insider, longtime contributor. Mr. Banks, thanks for joining us today. Are we right to be excited about the end of all this great labor coverage?
I don't know. I would hold on to a little bit of your skepticism. I think there's a little bit of doubt right now in the players' mind whether or not the owners are going to give on two fronts, and they're somewhat surprising. There's a hitch in the rookie wage scale negotiation, and there's a hitch in the basically the components of free agency and how it would work. The owners seem to want to try to get some up to three players per team a right of first refusal, and I think those are potential deal breakers, especially the free agency issue. So I think the needle's pointing firmly towards pessimism at the moment, and I agree with you. I think anytime you hear a date, you should write it in pencil, because we've heard July 4th, we've heard the 15th, and I had someone tell me last week within the league that, well, the 22nd is really the drop dead, because if we get it by then, the only game we lose is the Hall of Fame game, which is August 7th in Canton. The Rams and the Bears. But I think there's some serious work to be done this week, and I think this thing gets into next week.
You know, Don, and I mean, you made a really good point. Look, I've operated under the assumption all along that NFL players will have no problem throwing rookies under the bus. They'll have no problem, even as much as I hate to say it, throwing ex-players under the bus to a certain degree. But by God, they're not going to throw themselves under the bus as free agents.
Well, I mean, when you look at it, they basically, free agency was all but gutted last year because of the uncapped year, and the unrestricted free agency went to 6 years. Restricted free agency went up. And so in essence, the owners kind of had their off year for free agency. And now because there is a quote-unquote glut coming this year under the old rules, 4 years unrestricted, the owners are asking for, in essence, a one-time opportunity. I believe it's a one-time opportunity to protect up to three players per team. You could say that's only 96 players, but you can pretty much guess that that's going to be the top 96 players in free agency. I just don't see the players going for that. There are some players like a Vincent Jackson, the Chargers receiver. He may never get to free agency if he doesn't get to taste it again this year. So I think it's going to be an issue the players will go to the wall for. And then on the rookie wage scale, I think there's ground to figure that out. But right now the players are pretty uncomfortable with the idea of the first-rounders being allowed to be tied up for 5 years contractually before free agency, which is what the owners are going for.
Given that it is a lockout and given the we're coming upon the 10th anniversary of September 11th, the league has made a lot of noise about how they're going to tie in the opening of their season with that occasion. Do the players still not have a considerable amount of leverage here with that date getting closer and closer?
They have increasingly more. I think right now, I mean, that's still in the distance far enough that if they had to abbreviate the preseason and still start the season on time on September 11th with the first full Sunday of action, they could do that. So they're not sweating that yet, but yeah, that will grow increasingly larger on the horizon. Right now, you know, I think there's a real discrepancy. The owners have been continuing to beat the drum that this $800 million of potential revenue that the preseason generates is really important to growing, well, not growing, but going into the salary cap and allowing them to make their best possible offer to the players. I just don't think the players have the same sense of urgency on their side about the quote-unquote preseason TV revenues, and they don't want to make what they consider perhaps a short-sighted decision based on one preseason when really most of what they're fighting for is, you know, going forward in the next 4 to 10 years of a CBA agreement.
Don Banks of SI.com joins us on Primetime Sports. Don, I thought going into this, going into these negotiations, that the veteran player, and not the veteran players, retired players, that their benefits would be addressed in one way or another. I don't know the details about what has been negotiated so far. I do know that a lot of the veteran organizations are not happy with what they've seen. Was that too much to expect their issues to be addressed in this situation? Was that almost pie in the sky, do you think, or
no,
was there realistic?
I thought there was concern on both players and management side that they knew from a moral standpoint they kind of had to make this right. Now, I don't think the retired players have I don't think they have the benefit of speaking with one voice because there are different groups that represent them. I don't think they have a lot of legal ground to stand on. I think their best argument is a moral one. We helped build this game. Everything that has sprung forth from the NFL, monster popularity has come from the work we in part did. But I also think that right now, even that issue, you know, rather than a 50-50 split where the money for the legacy, quote-unquote legacy fund, is going to go to the retired players, 50-50 split is being, I think, quibbled about right now. I believe the owners want the players to take more of the money out of their cut to go to the retired players, and the current players are saying, you know, no, that's got to be more of an equitable split, and I think even that right now is an issue very much unresolved.
Let's presume this thing does get done. Do you think, a season starting on time and presumably with not much impact on the competitiveness, will it change the NFL offseason culture? I'm sure a lot of players are sitting around going, so this has been the best offseason of my career. I haven't been dragged into every mini camp and PDA, and I'm not working at a factory this summer, the NFL factory. Do you think it's the culture is going to change at all?
Somewhat, yeah. Not entirely, but already what we have heard as part of the negotiations that did kind of get agreed upon is a lessening of the off-season commitment level, less physical work in organized team activities, those OTAs that we love to talk about, less mini camps. I think Goodell got that message pretty early on that they probably had grown way out of proportion. And I think whatever comes out of the new CBA, it's going to be a slightly shrunken off-season conditioning program. There's going to be less of an ability for a coach to work his players. And I think that's laying the groundwork, guys, for a renewed push at some point for the 18-game schedule. I don't think they could do one without the other. And we know the 18 game is a non-starter right now, but I think in a couple years that will be back on the league's radar screen, and they will point to the fact that they made the quote-unquote football offseason shorter.
Don, listen, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully the end of your nightmare is just around the corner, because I know, I know.
Millions of others.
Labor issues aren't that's not how you want to make your bread and butter.
Any chance?
Certainly not my expertise. So you're generally faking your way through this type of coverage. I will say, I do believe by the end of July this thing is over. But I'd be hesitant to look at July 15th or even the 21st and say that those are really hard and fast dates.
Take care, Don.
Take care.
That is Don Banks of SI.com. When we come back, Luis Avila, president of the We Are America Coalition, will be along to talk about, Arizona's immigration law and whether or not we may expect any demonstrations tonight at the Home Run Derby or tomorrow at Major League Baseball's All-Star Game. That ahead on Primetime Sports. Yeah, I get so much abuse.
It's not because...
I got so much abuse doing this.
But I think it's sincere. A lot of times abuse is like affectionate joshing, but I actually think they don't like it.
Yeah, no, they don't. It's Grange and Blair in Primetime Sports, or Blair and Grange, however you want to look at it. That's Grange.
Did you hear that?
I hear everything they say to me.
No, it's true. They confirmed they don't like you.
No, that's all right. I don't really care. The feeling's mutual. I can see why McCown takes so much time off with the people he's got to work with back there.
I don't think that's a factor.
I don't think it is either. Major League Baseball's All-Star Game goes tomorrow night in Phoenix. The Home Run Derby will be held tonight. And you heard us talking earlier in the show about, last year, I want to say it was around June or July, Adrian Gonzalez and several other Major League Baseball players said that they would have an issue going to the All-Star game in Arizona as a result of Arizona's immigration law. Adrian Gonzalez at the time called it an immoral law. Well, the players are all there for the most part, at least the ones who didn't pull out for reasons of injury, or in the case of CC Sabathia, family trip to the Bahamas. But the rest of them have gone. And as far as we know right now, unless I haven't seen anything in the wires or anything, it doesn't appear as if anybody's made any sort of statement about the immigration law. And that has some of us surprised, because there are a great number of Latino players in the All-Star game. And indeed, a lot of the leading personalities in Major League Baseball are Latino. Luis Avila, president of the We Are America Coalition, joins us. And Luis, I just want to know from you, your group is an advocacy group. You've spoken out a lot about the immigration law in Arizona. And are you surprised, frankly, that there hasn't been much of any outcry from baseball players?
Well, Jeff, thank you for the invitation. First of all, you know, we were disappointed of the fact that people like Adrian changed their mind, right? Like a year ago, as you were mentioning, he called the law immoral. But you know, what we're forgetting about is that we're actually using this All-Star game as a platform to remind people of what's still happening here in Arizona, which is, you know, continuous harassment of immigrant communities, and also just politicians using this community as a way to gain political points. So there's a lot of Arizonans like myself who do not think that this is the right approach, who feel that there's more comprehensive ways to immigration, and that we should resolve them. And we're using this All-Star game as an opportunity, as a platform to address these issues.
Luis, for people who maybe aren't familiar, if you are a member of an immigrant community in Arizona, because of this law, what happens? You're driving along, you get stopped for illegal signal, or what happens?
The bill is called SB 1070, and the outcry comes because the bill specifies that anybody who's reasonably suspicious could be pulled over by any authority. What that means is that it would allow people to pull others based on the color of their skin, the car they drive, the music they listen to, you know, the clothes they're wearing. So that is basically a part of the law that they created the most outcry. But there's also other parts of the law. Jeff, let's say that you're driving your car and you get pulled over by a police person. You have a friend with you or someone with you who happens to be an undocumented immigrant. The cop pulls you over because you didn't have your seatbelt or because you know your broken taillight. He asks you for your documents. You show your documents, but the person with you doesn't show their documents. That means that you are also in compliance and not complying with the law, and you'll be also impacted by carrying an undocumented immigrant with you in your car. So that's some of the parts of the law. There's other parts that are also really controversial, but that's why we are responding like we are here in Arizona.
Luis, will you be taking the opportunity tomorrow to press your case? Will there be demonstrations or information? I guess informational pickets would be the right way to put it in front of the Chase Field.
Yes, actually, we've been there outside of Chase Field and outside the convention center since Friday, passing out ribbons, telling people about, you know, what's going on in Arizona, asking people to wear a white ribbon in support of our campaign. Today, the New York Times announced that Jackie Robinson's family will be at the games, and they will be wearing a white ribbon in support of our campaign. So we know that we have created awareness. You know, we are thank you for example, asking us to share more about our campaign. So this is exactly what we wanted. We wanted to talk about the fact that communities are being targeted, that what's happening in Arizona is not the right approach to immigration issues, and that unfortunately now other states like Alabama, like Georgia, are copying what happened in Arizona without knowing that it had a great impact in our communities. Hundreds of thousands of people left the state. Our economy is in shambles, and all this because a bad anti-immigrant law that was passed last year.
Luis, have you communicated with any specific players who may be more sympathetic or more understanding of the nuances of this law? And I guess for Toronto fans, Ricky Romero, for example, his son of so-called illegal immigrants, have you tried to find an ally for your cause within the clubhouse there?
Of course we have. We have been reaching out to many players, including Adrian Gonzalez, including Ozzie Guillen. We've been reaching out to people who are retired. And particularly our target, number one target was the Players Association. We were asking them, you know, we know what people are saying. Why are you using a sport to mix it with politics? We're not mixing politics with sports. We're just asking. When you're here in Arizona, you should make the case of you. They pride themselves in the MLB for always being in the forefront of civil rights since Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. But now, you know, they're being timid on this. We pushed them before they decided to come to Arizona to not choose the state as a place to host the event, and they did it anyways. Bud Selig, the commissioner for the MLB. So yes, we're contacting everyone. The commissioner received various letters, calls from national organizations. We've been in communication with players, and we're hoping that tomorrow we'll see some players coming out with ribbons or making statements as well.
Luis Avila joins us on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590. He is the president of the We Are America Coalition. What would it mean for your group if a name Major League Baseball player, let's say Adrian Gonzalez or Jose Bautista or whoever, were during the player introductions tomorrow to have a white ribbon, to take off their hat and show the white ribbon, for example, what would that mean to the organization?
Well, what do you mean? Look, to be honest, we're not doing this because we want any attention to our organization, but because we really want attention to what's happening to immigrant families. About 3,000 people are being detained in Arizona every single day. Over 400,000 people have been detained in this year alone. So over 56% of these people do not have any criminal background. There are people who have families, people who are, you know, who are going to work. So what we are warning is that these players, when they show the ribbon, when they're in the introduction and they're taking their hats off and in support of United Arizona, we want the country to understand that this issue is important to many, many people, including the athletes that they adore, the athletes that they celebrate.
Luis, we appreciate this. Your time. Time is not our ally. We have to run. We will be watching the All-Star game, and, we'll be keeping track of it. Back with Primetime tomorrow. Mr. Grange will be here. So will myself. Take care. Have a great night.